Hello and welcome to this episode of Stories of Hope by Kangaroo Minds. I'm Vedika and today we have with us Dr. Ashley Perkins. Dr. Ashley is a mental health advocate with a background as a pharmacist and an educator along with a doctorate in pharmacy. In 2020, Ashley moved towards forming We Matter Too, which focuses on helping those with mental health issues and mental disorders through first-person narratives of experiences. It is an organization which focuses on the idea that experiences can help people who are struggling with their mental health and are seeking support to assist them with moving over the barriers towards help seeking, stigma, and the fear of judgment. Before we begin our conversation to hear more from Ashley about her journey and her story, we'd like to put out a trigger warning for our audiences. If at any point during this conversation, should you find yourself feeling triggered or distressed, we urge you to take a step back and look after yourself. Should you need any additional support resources, you can also find them on our website. And now, without taking up much time, I'm going to hand over to Dr. Ashley. Dr. Ashley, welcome to the episode. It's such a pleasure to have you with us today.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. I'm really looking forward to, you know, everything that you're going to tell us about, you know, your journey, not just with your lived experience, but also with the work that you've done. And I know you have a book coming up as well.
Yes, I do. My book's titled I Matter Too. And really, it's just start to finish my journey with my mental health issues. It pulls out how I got my diagnoses as I got them clinically, how I experienced them personally. I mix in research along with, you know, kind of how I describe how I dealt with them.
Right.
So that you get kind of both that research, but also how I feel them. And then on top of that, just kind of all of my learning moments, all of my, you know, ups and downs, because I've had a lot of downs, unfortunately. And it's really, I wrote it to help others because I've gone through a lot in my life, and I felt that if I could write something that other people could read and maybe it would resonate with people, it might help others feel at least heard and seen. Because I know a lot of times throughout my time, as I've been dealing with these situations, I felt very alone going through a lot of these things. And I felt if somebody could read this and feel less alone, then maybe I could help somebody with these stories. And even though these stories are very hard for me to share, I just hope that by sharing them, it can help others. So that's why I wrote the book.
I think that's really interesting, you know, that the book kind of draws upon two aspects. One is from a very research or clinical aspect that this is what it is, but also, you know, your personal experience, because sometimes we know that when we look at just research or we look at symptoms purely as symptoms or diagnoses, we forget that everyone's going to experience this differently, right? Like there could be two people with the exact same diagnosis who are going to look at a whole different spectrum when it comes to the way that mental health disorder affects them.
Exactly. And so I really wanted to take, you know, both what you're going to read in a book and then really get inside my head and feel how I feel when I go through some of these situations. So that's kind of really what I wanted to do, to give you kind of my personal experiences as I go through some of these things. And then, of course, I go through a lot of really what I feel are the personal stories that I've gone through in my life that have attributed to a lot of my diagnoses. Because my personal diagnoses are, I've had ADHD my whole life, and then I've got generalized anxiety disorder, agoraphobia, which, to explain that to a lot of people who don't know, that is the clinical definition is the fear of open spaces. But really for me, it's, I don't enjoy being in crowded places. So I don't like to be where there's a lot of people. I don't like to be in like grocery stores, malls, especially when I don't feel like I can escape all of the people. So the pandemic's made it worse. which is wonderful. So really, I don't go out a lot. I stay home a lot. I go to work, I come home. That's about it. My therapist and I right now are working on me getting out more. I also have OCD. I have, I'm trying to think, PTSD now, after being discriminated against for my mental health in 2019. And all of the trauma that I dealt with for about 8 months, I ended up with PTSD from that. I've dealt with postpartum depression after having my son that led me to my first suicide attempt. And I ended up spending 5 days in the hospital after that. So I have dealt with postpartum, and I do have 2 suicide attempts. So I've dealt with a lot of mental health issues. I've also unfortunately dealt with alcoholism. I've had a DUI. Unfortunately, that's one of my larger unfortunate learning moments in my life. The alcoholism was a big problem for a long time because it was an unhealthy coping mechanism that I dealt with. It was my way of dealing with stress and shutting my brain off. If I had a bad day or my brain was doing its, you know, anxiety stuff and it's doom scrolling, and I wanted to shut it off, I just drank a lot. But I'm sober now. I've been sober now for over 3.5 years. So I don't drink anymore. Unfortunately, the DUI did not get me to quit drinking, unfortunately. But one day, actually January 1st of 2019, I woke up and just said, you know what, if I'm going to do this for my mental health, I'm going to quit drinking. So I did. And so I've been sober ever since. Best decision I ever made for my mental health was to be sober. And so that officially was the end of my drinking. And so I've dealt with a lot of things in my life that have led to what I believe a lot of my mental health issues, but you know, I've learned to deal with them, to navigate them, to overcome them. The PTSD has by far been the hardest thing for me to navigate. In October, I started dissociating because of the PTSD, which is another thing I've had to learn how to navigate. I'm angry because trauma was caused not by myself. It was caused by a group of people. So I get angry, I grieve, and it's something that I'm still dealing with, but I have a very good therapist who has been getting me through all of this, and I'm learning how to deal with PTSD. But really, sharing and raising awareness about mental health discrimination has led me to why I do all of this. Right. I started We Matter Too. I started speaking. I started being a very loud mental health advocate because of mental health discrimination. I realized if it could happen to me, someone who is very privileged, you know, being a white, educated person who has a lot of privileges at her, you know, at her feet, if I can be discriminated against for my mental health, I realized that it happens way more frequently than I realized at that time. And I had to do something about it because I couldn't just sit there and not do something about it. So I vowed that I was going to do something about it because I couldn't just sit there and not. And I couldn't let other people go through what I had gone through. And so that's when I left the organization that I was volunteering for at the time. One, I wasn't going to ever let another organization or a group of people ever do that to me again. And I was going to raise a lot of noise. And I told them that they'd hear from me again because I was clearly on a mission. And I started writing a book. I started raising awareness. And my friend and I started an organization. And here we are.
You've had a very interesting journey from what you said, and I'm sorry to hear about the discrimination that you had to go through. But as you rightly said, sometimes we realize that the privilege that we come from, if we're facing it, we don't know what other people are also going through. So it's interesting that through everything that you went through, you kind of found a purpose towards doing all the great work that you're doing. But also I wanted to say that, I'm really glad you're still here because you have been a survivor of two suicide attempts, as you mentioned. And, the work that, you're able to do now and the difference that you're making, I know that this is going to help a lot of people who are going through it and just need to know that, there is hope, and that it gets better. And also, yeah, I think the fact that, sometimes, I don't know, what are your thoughts around this? And, happy to listen, to your perspective, that, sometimes, have you seen the discrimination in the fact that we believe that, that mental health or poor mental health specifically or a mental illness has a specific kind of look? And, when people don't fit that norm of sorts, it becomes...
I, my husband and I, because we both volunteered for the same organization, and we were completely shocked. One, it was happening. And two, as it was happening, and as each thing would happen, we were just shocked. Like, it was going on, because every time I would say, this is wrong, this is happening, like, how do you not see how wrong this is? They were just like completely like, we don't know what you're talking about. And I'm like, how do you not see that this is wrong? Like, even on the basic level of just respecting another person. And this was a volunteer organization. It wasn't even like a work. Like, I wasn't even getting paid. It was just, all I was asking was for people to understand, like, this is just wrong on, let's respect another human being. This is all I wanted. And when I realized how low the bar was at this point, like, just getting people to recognize, like, we just need to understand respect at this point. And then once we got, it's just, it got so wildly out of like control that I was like, I don't even think they understand like any of it at all at that point. So then I was like, so to answer the question of like, it has its own, like, no, I don't even think people understand what it is.
Right.
I think that is the point, like the problem is there is an overall ignorance problem. And when you say the word ignorance, people automatically get defensive. They hear the word ignorance and they automatically put up this wall and they say, oh, not me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no. The word ignorance is not a bad word. It's not a bad word. It just means that you don't know something. That's exactly all it means. And it's all it means. People need to stop getting so defensive about the word ignorance. The word ignorance literally just means you don't know something and that you need to educate yourself. And I don't know why people get so offended by that word, but they do. Because every time you say the word ignorance, people get offended. But I would say, you guys, you're just... there is a lack of education around mental health, what it is, what it is not, and what you are doing.
Yeah.
You're ignorant to what mental health discrimination is. And every time I would say that, they'd all get defensive. And I'm like, and I think that's what it was. Because every time I would say, you guys don't know what this is, they would get, their hackles would go up and everyone would get defensive with me. And I'm like, and I seriously think that's what it was, is that there is seriously a lack of education and there's a huge ignorance about what mental health discrimination is, what stigma is, And this is where I think the core of the problem is that people just have no clue what it is.
I think it's interesting, you know, the aspect that you brought up about ignorance. And I think somewhere ignorance and mental health stigma and like lack of awareness is something which unfortunately or ironically is universal. You look at different countries and they're all at different levels of ignorance and, you know, stigma and lack of awareness. And when it comes to, you know, getting defensive, it's true because I think people feel that you're accusing them of not knowing enough. But the fact is that we don't know everything about everything, you know, but somehow I think mental health is one of those things where being told you're ignorant, people tend to take it more badly than if it came to something else. Like if someone said that, you know, you don't know enough about astrophysics, they wouldn't mind as much as if you told them that you're ignorant about mental health, or, you know, you're not aware enough.
Yes. Yes. And every time I would push further to say, all I'm doing is asking you to be better for people. That's it. I'm not asking you to do anything else. And I would always include myself in it. I would say we. I would include myself in it because I too can do better for other people. I too can do better. Everybody can do better. We all can work together to do better. I never took myself out of the equation. So I think every time an advocate or another person or any of us goes into this and you say you need to do better for your mental health, whatever, for your people, they get very defensive. But I never take myself out of the equation because no matter what it is, I can always do better for the mental health of other people. I always include myself because no matter what it is, I can always do better for the mental health of anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so people, I think when it comes to the mental health, people need to stop being defensive and remembering that we always can do better when it comes to mental health, everyone. And there's no need to be defensive about it. It's just being open-minded to the fact that we don't know it all and that you need to be open to hearing the perspectives of others.
And, you know, coming back to, you know, your journey and your story, and I know you've written about it in your book and you briefly spoke about it in your TEDx talk as well, but for our audiences, can you just share a little bit about, you know, what your journey has been like through, you know, the mental health challenges that you faced as well as being in recovery? What has it looked like for you?
So I take medication. That's always a very touchy situation for a lot of people. I am a pharmacist. I do take medication. However, I'm very open to all ways, but I do take medication. I have to. It's just the way I've come to this conclusion that for me and my mental health, I have to take medication every day because in order for myself to live, especially with ADHD, if not, I literally couldn't function. My brain would be all over the place. And then I do therapy. I love my therapist. She specializes in PTSD too, which has been a massive help to me, especially over the last few years. I also dealt with bullying as a child. When I was younger, in elementary school, I was bullied horribly by a group of girls because, again, I had ADHD, so I was different, especially when I was younger, because I was growing up in the 90s. So in the 90s, we didn't really talk about mental health. Mental health was very different when I was a kid, because I'm 38. So when I was a kid, you know, it really wasn't talked about. I was the talkative. I was the talkative kid. I was the one who always had the self-control problems on her grade card because I had ADHD. I didn't sit still very well. So I was, you know, the awkward smart girl. So I got bullied a lot by the girls in school. So I went through a lot when I was growing up. I didn't tell my parents. I've actually talked to my parents about it when I was writing that part of the book, because my parents, I asked them, I was like, did I talk about this? And my parents were like, no, you didn't mention it. She's like, you, my mom was like, you mentioned a little bit about it, but she's like, you didn't tell us all of this. Mm-hmm. I also mentioned it to one of my fifth grade teacher, a little bit. I've spoken to him too. He said I mentioned a little bit of it. That's why he would let me stay in during recess, because I would get bullied on the playground. So he would let me stay in during recess so I didn't have to go out. So when we moved, seventh grade year, that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because then I got away from all of that. And for me, middle school and high school wasn't bad, because I was just pretty much, I was like middle of the crowd. So like, no one really hated me. No one really liked me. I just kind of got along. So I hated that elementary school because it was just awful. And then as I got older, I went to college, dealt with that alcoholism, and, you know, pharmacy school, I mean, it flat out sucked. It was hard. I mean, it was the hardest thing I've ever done. You're studying all the time. You're trying to get through it. Luckily, I had an amazing group of friends to get through it with. But we drank a lot. That's how we got through it. We had a lot of fun. I have to say that. But we drank a lot. Unfortunately, I didn't stop. I just kept doing it. And I was a bit destructive, like I said. Again, dealing with the postpartum was really rough. They don't do a very good job, at least where I was living at the time in rural Maryland. They didn't do a very good job of screening, especially with someone they knew had mental health issues going into pregnancy and then having a baby. They should have been watching me better. I mean, I had a therapist, and I chose not to take my, at the time, I was only taking one medication. I did not take my Celexa at the time. I chose not to take it. You can safely take it during pregnancy. It's okay. I chose not to. So I didn't take mine when I was pregnant. And then I started it while I was in the hospital. I started taking it again. I told them that I dealt with mental health issues when I started going to the pediatrician with my son. They didn't watch me extra careful. They didn't do anything special. They have you fill out a survey every time you bring the baby into the pediatrician, but nothing extra special, no extra care or anything like that. Of course, I was ignoring it because I'm a pharmacist, medical professionals, that's what we do. And I was seeing a therapist, so I thought I was fine. And then one day, my friend who's on our board, she's a counselor. I was talking to her on the phone, and I was about to go to work. I dropped Wyatt off before I go to work, and I was driving to work. I had talked to her, and she was really worried about me, and it was a bad day. And, I dropped my son off, and in between dropping my son off and getting to work, I thought about driving my car into a pole. And it, of course, scared me. And I walked up to my boss's office, and not even thinking about the ramifications of my job. I mean, I clearly didn't think that through. I just walked up to my boss's office and stood. He had a glass window on his door, and I was just standing in his door crying. And he was on the phone. He's like, I gotta call you back. And I walked into his office and just told him what happened. He took me straight to the hospital. He was like, I don't care if you have to work, I'm taking you to the hospital. He's like, you don't need to be at work, you need to not be here. And I was like, but I have to work. And he goes, I don't care. he was like, that's not where you need to be right now. So he made me call my husband and he took me straight to the hospital, and I was in the hospital for 5 days, and then I went back to work after 2 weeks, and they put me on a lower schedule, and I had accommodations at work and everything, and they were great. They treated me great. I mean, it was amazing. I've never worked at a better company. It was wonderful. So, but yeah, so I've been through a decent amount of things, but it's always been, you know, dealing with them as they come. And I've always had therapists there to help me while I get through it. Therapy's always been important to me. I usually have used it as a reactive measure, but after my postpartum, I started to use it as a proactive measure. I knew I needed to stop being reactive and be proactive. After that, I started just going as a proactive measure.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you've spoken about aspects where, you know, you were able to get help and there were some people who supported you in your journey. Then, you know, what have been some of, you know, the high points as well, and even the low points through this, you know, that you've been through?
I am very fortunate to have a husband who has been my, sorry, I apologize. I have a husband who is by far the most supportive husband ever. He is my rock, and he has gotten me through all of these things. You know, he kept me alive during the discrimination and everything. Of course, that postpartum, I had a wonderful son who we love very much and is now six and a half years old. You know, wonderful, wonderful child. We are very fortunate to have him. So he's wonderful and we love him very much. And, you know, all the stuff that I'm doing now by far is, I never would have thought that I could make a comeback like this, but I'm so determined to do what I'm doing now, because we have to stop this stigma and we have to raise the awareness that we're raising, and the work that so many advocates are doing now to raise the awareness, to stop the stigma, you know, me, you, you know, so many that we've met, because it needs to be done. And I knew I could do it. That was never a question. I've always been somebody who would never give up. But this, the stuff that I've been doing since 2019, this has been one of the greatest things I've ever done. And watching myself do this is probably one of the proudest moments of my life, my career. You know, I've been able to, you know, the things I'm doing in therapy, my mental health, you know, my career, what I'm building with my friend John, with We Matter Too, the thing I'm building professionally just for myself, all these things that I've done, and I'm doing it with PTSD. So I'm like, I can't speak enough about the stuff that I'm doing now. I couldn't be prouder. And I just know that I'm going to continue doing this, and I'm going to continue to raise awareness, and I'm not going to stop anytime soon. And this is just, I know that I've found what I'm now supposed to be doing. It may have taken me 36 years, however long it took me, but now I know what I'm supposed to be doing, because this is the stuff that invigorates me. This is the stuff that I enjoy doing, and I could talk about this type of stuff all day long.
I think that's interesting, you know, that, you know, when we're able to find that purpose through what we've been through, we'll also be able to help other people. And I think a lot of you know, coming back to the work that, you know, you do with We Matter Too, as well as, you know, your upcoming book, you focused a lot on, you know, like lived experience narratives, right? Like people sharing their stories to help other people go through it. But when it comes to, you know, lived experience, I just wanted to know, like, where do you sort of tend to draw that line between lived experience and professional expertise?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, peer support is important, but we have professionals who have gone through extensive training. So peer support, us with lived experience, are kind of that ground to sustain people until they can get to professionals with the training. You know, in the United States, we have a shortage of professionals. You know, therapists, counselors, social workers, we don't have enough. And people are waiting extensive amounts of time to get into those professionals. So that some of them are waiting 2-3 months before they can get into a trained professional. And I see peer support as those people sustaining our community until they can get into those professionals. Mm-hmm. Like, I see peer support as that like middle ground, mm-hmm. where we're helping, you know, our community lean, they can lean on us until they can get to those professionals, you know, because if somebody has questions about their medication, they wouldn't just go ask anybody questions about their medication. They come find a pharmacist like me. You know, I've literally gone to school for 6 years to learn everything I can about the drugs. They'd come ask me the questions about the drugs. I mean, my family does it all the time. They pick up the phone and they call me, which they should. It's all stuck up here. But, you know, therapists, counselors, social workers, they are the people that if you need a counselor, you should go to a counselor. Peer support should never be a substitute for counselors and social workers. Peer support's kind of like that middle ground before you get there. You know, just kind of that sustaining middle ground. I think I've heard people, or you've described it as, you know, like CPR, you know, first aid, you know, that just kind of help you, but until you can get to those professionals.
I think, you know, that's the point, right? Like, you know, when we talk about lived experiences, and that was one of the reasons why we started Stories of Hope as well, which is, you know, to hold space for people who have been through, you know, a mental health journey, for them to share their stories, but also to realize that this is it, you know, this is their story. Their story doesn't make them someone, unless they've been through professional training, which is then an entirely different space. But otherwise, this is it, you know, this is their story. This is them being an inspiration, but this is not them being a mental health professional.
And a lot of people become therapists, social workers, counselors, because they have lived experience. That is one reason they get inspired to become those things. And I mean, and actually I have a story, which is in my book. My grandfather passed away because of medical malpractice. So because of a doctor, he ended up dying. It happened while I was in pharmacy school. So I vowed to be the type of pharmacist that I am. I vowed that I'd never take decisions away from my patients. So I'm the type of pharmacist that is very patient-centered. I really work with my patients, and I, you know, patients always have the choice, and I don't take decision-making away from my patients, because I've been through that. I've been through the situation where decisions were taken away from my grandparents. My grandpa wasn't able to make those decisions because a doctor took it away from him and ended up killing him. So I empathize with people who have gone through that situation. So, you know, I became that type of pharmacist because I've gone through it. So lived experiences in those situations can lead to that. And so, you know, I know plenty of you know, therapists and counselors and social workers who have lived experience, who have gone on to become that. So for sure, lived experience has its place in that, for sure.
No, I definitely agree. You know, and like there are so many lived experience individuals who are also mental health advocates, you know, like yourself as well. And there is this place, but it's just sometimes being aware that, you know, of your own role as an individual with lived experience, that you can be a great peer support, but peer support, as we said, is like a CPR. You have to guide the person to professional support, even if you're from a mental health first aid background. You know, there are limitations to the roles that we have.
But, absolutely.
You know, coming back to, again, to your journey and everything that you mentioned, you spoke about discrimination, you spoke about stigma as well, right? And a lot of times I think, you know, you might have seen it as well, where in terms of stigma, we tend to focus, a lot of our mental health conversations tend to center around depression and anxiety. Like, you know, somewhere we have a little more acceptance towards those and a little more awareness, I want to say, about depression and anxiety as opposed to other mental health conditions. So have you seen that, or, you know, have you had to experience that as well?
Yeah, I think because anxiety and depression are more common. I think they're more commonly diagnosed overall. So people are more comfortable talking about them. And a lot of times depression and anxiety will normally see as everyday normal emotions, because depression, sadness, right? Sadness is a normal emotion. Anxiety can be an everyday normal emotion. It's easier to talk about normal emotions. Now, anxiety becomes a not normal emotion when it gets into debilitating levels. Again, depression, debilitating levels, then it becomes a diagnosed problem. I think people are more comfortable talking about both because, again, at regular levels, it's a normal emotion. When we get into the other diagnoses, schizophrenia, obsessive compulsive disorder, PTSD, it's starting to get into the realm of thing people aren't, they can't wrap their brain around it because it's not something they deal with. Therefore, they can't understand it. So, or if they don't have a loved one who deals with it, it's harder for them to understand. So they don't want to talk about uncomfortable things. They don't want to start to, you know, get into where they have to be uncomfortable or, you know, put themselves outside of, you know, their box. So people don't like to be uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And so when we ask them to sit in their uncomfortable, that's when people want to shut down and they don't want to listen anymore. And that's when we get into the other mental health issues. And so I think people really want to stay where people are comfortable, which I get, but it's not fair because there are so many people who have other mental health issues and they feel left out of the conversation because they have the other ones. And that shouldn't be that way because they want to be included in this conversation and they need to be involved in the conversation, and it's people need to start getting uncomfortable. The only way that we can get rid of stigma is if people are uncomfortable, and we can't just do this if people are comfortable. Mm-hmm. And we got to start getting people uncomfortable. That's the only way this is going to work, and that involves people just sharing their stories. And I've seen, and I love following a few of them on Twitter, and they openly talk about their stories with schizophrenia, and they've been sharing, and I'm so glad they do, because they should. And we shouldn't be sugarcoating it. That's why my book's not sugarcoated. It shouldn't be. Why should we be sugarcoating our stories? No, but people need to watch their language when they speak about us. I don't have to sugarcoat my story. It's my story to tell. However, people need to watch their language when they speak about us. There's a difference. Yeah. And when I talk about language, see, I research language. I'm working on my doctorate in education, and I research language as it pertains to mental health stigma. And it's very fascinating to me, and I love it. But again, it comes from the whole discrimination thing, because people need to understand their words have weight.
Right.
So as I share my story, I can tell it in any way I want. But people need to understand when they talk about us, they need to watch how they talk about us. And they need to use the proper language, because the proper language is important. And we need to also start to remove certain words from our language, because that's important too. And so I'm always getting on people about not using certain words, because certain words need to be removed. We need to be using certain words. And so that as well is important, you know, when it comes into when we're sharing stories and when we're writing blogs, when we're tweeting, when we're doing all these things, we also need to be watching how we go about talking about it too.
No, I think I completely agree. I think, you know, that's you and me both, because so many times you will see, even in a media sense, like, you know, you will refer to things like, this was a bipolar election, or this is, you know, career suicide, or, you know, like, you know, so and so, this is a schizophrenic thing to do. And it's like, mental health terms are not labels to be used, you know, so casually. You don't just say addict, you know, you would say someone struggling with substance use. And even like, just coming back to, as you said, you know, person first language. But since we're on this whole thing about, you know, language and how we talk about mental health, do you think in your experience, you know, what have been some things that people have said to you that have been helpful as well as, you know, not helpful throughout your journey?
I can't think of anything specific. Mm-hmm. Well, I know the whole discrimination thing. That's why I got into language, because the whole discrimination thing was what, because before the discrimination thing, I didn't care. I was a whole, like, words can never hurt me person before the discrimination, because I thought words were just, words are just words, you know, before the discrimination. After the discrimination, that's when I realized words do matter, because words almost killed me. That's when I realized how much words really can hurt a person, because it was all verbal. It was all in email. It was all, you know, they didn't touch me. They didn't come, you know, they never came near me. It was all words. And that's when I realized how much words do matter. And that's when I got fascinated with language and the words and stigma. And I really started to dig into it, especially with writing the book. And with me working on my doctorate in education, because when I started teaching, you know, I went to pharmacy school. They taught me how to do pharmacy. They didn't teach me how to teach. So I did want to learn how to teach effectively when I started teaching. So that's why I started working on that. And I started really digging into this idea of how can we make our medical professionals better for our patients when it comes to mental health. And that's when I got into this, really, how do we get them better at their language? So I really started digging into mental health stigma and the language. And it's in my book too. I have a lot of this in the book as well. And just the language and the words we use and the self-stigma and the societal stigma and the institutional stigma and these words that, and a lot of times I'll bring it up sometimes on Twitter. I'll ask, which do you prefer, mental illness, mental disorder? Which do you prefer? Because a lot of people do prefer a difference. Some people prefer mental illness. I prefer mental disorder. a lot of times medical professionals will prefer mental disorder because we're just more clinical.
Yeah.
Okay. We're more clinical. So we think more in the mental disorder realm because disorder doesn't bother us. More patients who are more lay people, they'll prefer mental illness because they don't like the way disorder sounds.
Yeah.
They just don't like that. So they prefer mental illness, where I don't like illness because it sounds like I'm sick, where I don't feel sick. I just feel like I have a disorder, right? I don't think disorder makes me sound bad, but people feel like disorder makes them sound bad. So I've learned through the times I've asked on Twitter, it's very polarized on which one people prefer. So for me, I tell people, the clinicians need to learn what the patient says is what they need to say. You need to be mimicking what your patient says. If your patient comes in and says mental illness, you need to be saying mental illness. Mm-hmm. If your patient comes in and says mental disorder, you need to be saying mental disorder. Don't say whatever you want. Say what the patient is saying. Mimic your patient. Because if you're mimicking what your patient says, you're going to make your patient more comfortable. And that's where I've been like getting into these conversations with a lot of people has made me learn that if we're mimicking our patient's language, we're going to make our patients more comfortable. We need to mold to our patients more than us being so centered in our language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I get where you're coming from, because there will be a lot of times where people would prefer neither, right? Like they would be like mental health, like poor mental health, or you know, a mental health problem, and we still need to be accepting of that as well, that they may not want to call it either an illness or a disorder. And there may be also be people who don't like the notion of, you know, like, well, you know, you imply that someone is broken and they need to be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Also another thing, a lot of people don't like this whole notion of, you know, the terminology around this, like, you know, your brain is broken, or, you know, like we will pick therapists will fix people because, you know, you're not a thing, you're a person. So, you know, again, it comes back to how do we use like person first language and just sort of humanize somebody. I think that just language itself can be so empowering.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and a lot of the language conversations that I've had with people have been difficult because I have to break down my ego as a professional and as a provider and see it from everybody's perspective. And I have to be like, no, I have to open this up and listen to people to see where they're coming from. Because yeah, I am a patient. I am a patient too. However, I really want to see what everyone's perspectives are from this space of what language do other people want?
Yeah.
And hearing these discussions that I have had on Twitter with everybody about language, it's really, it's been fascinating to hear everybody's perspectives on language, and I've learned so much. And it's been fascinating. And I think that's where I've come to this realization that as professionals, if we're able to just mimic our patients when they come in with certain types of language, that we would make patients more comfortable. And I think patients would feel less stigmatized if we were able to do that.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting, you know, like all the learnings that you've shared, which also stemmed a lot from your experiences, but also with a lot of interactions with people. But you know, to sort of wrap up the entire conversation that we've had today, you know, if you could give some advice to anyone who's watching this or listening to this right now, and is having a hard time with their mental health, what would that be?
Oh, give yourself grace. That's what I always tell people. It's hard because our brain is telling us no. Our brain is telling us no. And you just got to tell your brain it's a butthead, because your brain is a butthead. I tell my brain all the time. But you deserve grace. Always. Because you're doing the best you can. If you're surviving, then you're doing the best you can. And that you deserve grace. And it's hard to give it to yourself. And it's almost impossible sometimes, but you deserve it always.
No, thank you for that. And thank you for joining us and, you know, not just sharing your story, but also so many insights and suggestions on how, you know, we all can do better in our own space, how we can keep continuously improving and also spreading the awareness to help someone feel more supported. I really appreciate your time. I appreciate, you know, you being here, and, you know, more power to you for everything that you're doing. Looking forward to your book.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it too. I'm almost done.
Okay, so that's nice. So we're going to probably see your book soon. And so lastly, for anyone who's watching or listening to this today, you know, just as even Dr. Ashley said, you know, if you're having a hard time today, please know that there is help out there and it gets better. So be compassionate with yourself. There's no need for you to be suffering in silence. Reach out, speak to someone you trust, or reach out to a mental health professional and know that it gets better. So till next time, please stay well and stay healthy. Thank you.